thing, actually. It's anonymous who stays there. We don't say countries, we don't say names, we don't tell people's stories, because in fact, in part, we want to respect their privacy. If people have gone through such traumatic experiences, who are we to go out and share it and spread it and almost exploit it? So we don't share that type of information. Also, in terms of privacy, they really need it. We talked about confidentiality. It's really important to keep their location secret. So when we look at confidentiality, we are a confidential location. We don't publish our address. We don't even tell people where it is. People say, where is it? Where is it? And I'd love to say, but I'll just identify the county we're in, and that covers a zillion miles, so that's pretty broad, and that's about as specific as I'll get. We also have a number of other confidentiality measures that we take in place. We have security at the house, obviously. We do a lot of training. So for any volunteers or staff who work at the house, they go through this 5-day training where we cover a number of issues, including confidentiality, because they need to keep the place confidential. Where they park, what they say when they're around the house, what they say outside of the house. We have them sign confidentiality agreements, et cetera, et cetera. So we really take a lot of measures in the folks we work with to protect the confidentiality. And then with the residents themselves, you know, we go over the safety protocols with them. And you need to think about a number of different things. Maybe if they even have a cell phone, that cell phone might have a GPS tracker. So we talk to them about that. We offer them other cell phones that are new, that don't have tracking. We talk about Facebook and the internet and how people can be traced pretty easily. It's really important because some survivors are threatened with a lot of really scary threats. Could be acid. I'll throw acid if I catch you. I'm going to hurt you if I catch you. I'm going to do this if I find you. And so they really need to feel safe. So we put all these protocols into place for each resident so that the rest of the residents are safe as well as the individuals. There's also a lot of fear. When we talk about shelter homes, that sounds pretty scary, actually. I don't know how many people have gone to different kinds of shelter homes. You want to raise your hand if you've ever been to a shelter home? That can mean a lot of different things, as you've probably seen. Some of them are kind of scary to go into, or it may not feel safe. And so for victims of trafficking, given their trauma and kind of their confidentiality needs, we kind of go, when we meet them, we try to reach out to them off-site, where we introduce them to one of the staff members so they get a sense of who we are, to kind of relieve some of that fear. And then also we bring pictures of what the house looks like on the inside so that they can have a sense of, okay, what will it be like when I go there? And we try to do a lot of different kinds of measures to help alleviate some of that fear. And actually, we do have pictures of what it looks like on the inside at our expo table if you're interested. So we've seen a lot of different things since we opened in just a short time. People also ask me, well, what kind of surprises have you had? Probably one of the biggest surprises that I've had is how much work there is still to do to identify victims. I think we heard a little bit in the plenary session this morning that still we need identification. You hear all the estimates. 27 million slaves worldwide, up to 17,500 slaves trafficked into the U.S. every year, 100 to 300,000 minors at risk of sex trafficking. All of these statistics you hear all the time. When you look at how many traffickers have been identified and prosecuted and the number of victims that have been identified, the numbers are much smaller. You know, in 2009 worldwide, there were 5,600 prosecutions, 49,000 victims identified. That's a small number compared to the number of estimates of slaves out there. The U.S. as well, I think in 2009, the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney, which is this one division that works on trafficking, charged 114 individuals. So that means there's really a lot of work to do still in identifying and reaching out to victims. We always hear it, you know, it's the invisible visible, right in front of your face and you can't see it. So what we started to do is we worked a lot in the first few months in terms of awareness raising to local agencies and others. And you'd be surprised by how many misconceptions there still are out there, that trafficking is an international problem, that it's only sex trafficking, that it doesn't happen in this wealthy area. I mean, you heard Lieutenant Bannock say that tonight, oh, it doesn't happen. And that's exactly what I've been hearing too when I go out. It's surprising, but in the last 4 months, in about 4 month period, we did about 35 trainings and meetings where we reached out to local agencies, law enforcement, medical communities, community-based organizations to kind of bring, okay, what does trafficking look like on a local level? And I heard many times, it doesn't happen here. We don't see it. Oh, we don't see it. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen here. So we had to do a lot of work in persuasion, actually. We brought a lot of case studies, different newspaper articles that identified the trafficking that has happened and the exploitation that has happened in affluent neighborhoods, with wealthy individuals, in all types of neighborhoods, in all types of trafficking, in all types of establishments. We also worked on just kind of trying to dispel a lot of the myths. You know, even the fact that you could be here legally. A number of people think, okay, if it's trafficking, well, it's someone who came here illegally, they may not have documents, but actually, in fact, someone may be here legally. They may have a T visa, a student visa, a valid work visa. They may obviously be a U.S. citizen. So working on providing really explicit examples of, okay, well, what do you actually see, and who might you come across? And what we found is that this effort has really paid off. We've reached out to all these organizations that had never been involved in trafficking before, who had identified victims within their caseloads, and they now started making referrals. In fact, one organization that we worked with have made 5 referrals, and this is an organization that had never identified a victim of human trafficking previously. So I think it starts to show you that actually, this is something that needs to be done, continuous outreach and education at the very, very local levels. The other interesting thing that we try to emphasize too is that victims are difficult to identify. Other agencies may not be serving victims of human trafficking. They may be serving victims of domestic violence, victims of sexual assault. Folks who may be a community resource center that works with people who need food and housing and basic services. Well, sometimes victims need those basic services, and maybe they escape their situation of trafficking, but now they need, they still need food, they still need housing. And just because they may have escaped one type of trafficking or exploitation situation doesn't mean that they're free or that they're not vulnerable to another situation of exploitation. They were vulnerable before, and unless some other intervening factor gave them an opportunity to kind of remove some of the vulnerabilities, they're still going to be vulnerable to exploitation. So we try to reach out to those agencies to kind of say, okay, you may not see someone who identifies as a victim of human trafficking. They may just say that they need food or they need housing, but here's some tools of what you can do to help identify. In fact, we gave intake questions to a few agencies so they can kind of add that to their forms when they start doing questions. Brochures, we offer brochures where people can self-identify and a number of different other little tools like that. So what impact have we had in the last few months? We've done a lot of trainings, as I said, about 35 trainings to different agencies. We also did a training for volunteers to work at the shelter home. We trained about 20 volunteers to work at the home. It was a 5-day training that they went through to kind of prepare themselves. We trained advocate volunteers, and then we worked with a number of survivors. We've housed 8 survivors. I think currently we have 6 survivors, and with a capacity of being 8. And then we've worked with a number of other survivors, maybe 15 other survivors. I think one of the biggest impacts that we have is not just the numbers that we've reached, but the responses that we've gotten from the residents themselves. And we've been pretty excited that folks who have stayed at the house have really enjoyed and really felt safe there. So one resident wrote a note and they said, I finally feel like I have a home. One resident who came said, I feel free. One resident came and said, I feel safe. That's really important. It's a really important need to meet people who are afraid and who haven't had the space to heal. As I said, we've worked with other survivors as well. I think we've responded to 15 survivors who may not need housing, but still need other resources, whether it be information or referrals or just someone to talk to, knowing that they have an option, or maybe someone who is not in a good situation but isn't ready to leave. Just kind of reaching out to them and talking with them and letting them know that we're here, we are an option, and we'll be here for you. I think that's really important as well. So what can you do? I know that this whole summit is about how you can change the world and end human trafficking. And I think there's something that everyone can do. If you want, at Freedom House, we have a shelter volunteer program. As I said, we did one last summer, and we're gonna be doing another shelter volunteer training this spring in about April, May. If you're interested, you can sign up either on our website or at the table. And we have volunteers doing so many different activities. So there's so many ways to kind of provide aftercare services to the residents. We have a yoga certified instructor who comes and does yoga. We have a volunteer to do pottery, and we got a pottery kiln and throwing wheel and supplies donated at this offsite location. We have volunteers who provide ESL support. We have volunteers who even come and do different field trips, take people ice skating, to movies, to the park, playing tennis, basketball, like really simple things that helps people just to build companionship and some support. We have a licensed counselor who comes and provides group counseling. So there's a lot of ways to get involved as a volunteer if you're interested in aftercare specifically. And then, of course, we're always looking for, if people want to contribute financially too, of course, that's always welcome. That's always a need. Got to plug that in, just to let you know. but yeah, I don't want to take too much time. That's a little bit of what you can do and a little bit of what we can, what we've done. And I'd be happy to stick around and answer some questions after that. So thank you for your time. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me fine? Great. So I'm Annie Fukushima, and I'm the lead trafficking case manager and programs coordinator at the SAGE Project. And I have my colleague here joining me, Molly Ring. She's the director of the trafficking programs. We do have a table with volunteers, so we have our clinician, our mental health clinician here with us, as well as another staff member that's part of our team. So please feel free to ask any of us questions. So just to give you a little bit of a sense about what's going to happen is I'm going to share with you about SAGE, who we are, and some of our services. I'm also going to historicize some of the changes, because we are in a particular moment right now of an anti-trafficking movement. And services and all the things that are going on are changing. And so that means it impacts how we are able to serve survivors of human trafficking. Another thing I'm going to talk about is what a service provision for the SAGE Project looks like. For Freedom House, they have a different service provision model because they're a shelter. We are not. And then the last thing is going to be SAGE lessons and recommendations. So from today, you're not going to get a 101 on human trafficking. If you have questions, I'm more than happy to share with you about legal definitions, certification processes, and stuff like that. But this is just really an overview. So the SAGE Project. The SAGE Project was founded in 1995 by Normal Hoteling. Norma Hotelling was a survivor of child sex trafficking. She was able to get out of her trafficking experience because of her own resiliency. She went to school at State, and what she really wanted to do was found an agency that would help survivors like herself take the steps towards healing. And so she founded the SAGE Project. 50% of our staff are survivors of commercial sexual exploitation or trafficking-like experiences. And so when we say that we are survivor-informed, we really mean it. Our staff are at the front lines, many of them are survivors, and we are working with survivors, learning from them what we need to help support them. Our mission is to improve the lives of those victimized by or at risk for sexual exploitation, violence, and human trafficking. And that's a big mission. And I think that one of the things is we do it both at the local and at the global scale. Some of our programs include the trafficking units. We also have the Early Intervention Prostitution Program. That is a program for those that are arrested for prostitution. They're given an option of coming into our programs, and they work with peers as well as with survivor staff. We have the Trauma and Recovery Center, the STAR Center. At the SAGE Project, we recognize that many survivors of trauma self-soothe with drugs, and so we have programs that help them develop other self-soothing mechanisms so they don't need to revert to old practices that are also the same things that may exploit them. We also have the First Offender Prostitution Program. This is also known as the John School. We work with SFPD and the district attorney's offices, in which Johns are given an option. They either go to jail because there is enough evidence to convict them, or they have the other option. They go to our John School and they hear from survivors. They hear from the community, they hear from healthcare people, and they talk about what it is that they are doing and how it impacts the community. And then we have the youth component that works in juvenile justice centers, in which we are doing outreach to at-risk and sex trafficked girls. So the SAGE trafficking, anti-trafficking programs, we do many things, but just to give you a sense of the snapshot of what we do, is we advocate for victims and survivors of human trafficking. We also provide comprehensive services. So every single thing that they may need, we try to support them in accessing it through a referral system if we don't have it in-house. We also help them take the steps towards advocating themselves eventually. We increase awareness by training the community. And this is a huge important factor with our work, because the reality is, as you guys know here today, is the anti-trafficking movement doesn't begin with just one person. It takes an entire movement of people working together. And so we really depend on the community and other organizations within the community to help us identify, as well as to help us provide services for survivors of human trafficking. And we work with our friends such as Freedom House. A snapshot of our clients. We work with people of all genders, male, female, transgendered. We also work with people of a variety of ages, from 10 years old to as young to up to their 60s. So we're working with a wide range of people in ages. As far as the country, we primarily see, as far as the international trafficking programs, we primarily see individuals that come from Latin America and Asia, and that's because of where we're located. So we haven't seen very huge cases of European and African continent-based cases, but we've seen a couple, but not a huge amount. We work with survivors of labor, sex, and labor and sex trafficking. We also, one of the things is, this is just a number, it doesn't really give you a sense of what it looks like on the service spectrum. On average, we see about 700 people a year. The title's wrong for this, sorry. I'm like the typo queen, so just ignore any typos you see in the presentation. This is just to give you a snapshot, though, when we talk about sex and labor trafficking. So between 2009 and 2010, we provided comprehensive case management, so that means wraparound services for international survivors of human trafficking. 65% of those were labor. For the crisis response we did 52 cases in that same period, and we found that the numbers increased as far as sex trafficking, so 54% were sex trafficked. And with our domestic minor trafficking program, we worked with 92% of them were sex trafficked. So what we are seeing is that our children are primarily sex trafficked. Internationals, there's higher numbers of labor trafficking. And so I think that's just to give you a sense of what we're seeing on the ground. But this isn't a comprehensive picture. This is just what we see as service providers. So I want to historicize some of the changes that we've done as far as providing services.
So in 1995, our program started with injustice in the juvenile justice programs, outreaching to commercially sexually exploited children and sex trafficked girls. And so we started in the Juvenile Justice Center, and in 1997, we then developed the Life Skills Program, which is helping youth develop the life skills that they need to either survive or to thrive. And so that began in 1997. And one of the things that we really were beginning to make the connections with is what we call commercial sexual exploitation of children is domestic minor sex trafficking. The two are the same. In 2002, we then started to work with international survivors of human trafficking because we were funded by Office of Refugee and Resettlement. And part of the campaign, you'll see some of our campaign materials out front too, our chapsticks and our banner that we put out. In 2005, we opened a safe house for sex trafficked girls. And this was opened because we had a partnership with ESSA Foundation as well as with the city. And this is, I don't know how many of you have read the book called A Piece of Cake. Has anyone read that book? It's a great book. It's by a survivor of child sex trafficking, and she was also surviving in the foster system, and so surviving many other things. But one of the things that she did say about the house for the girls is the safe house is critical. And so she said, you can't just walk out of that life. You need somewhere to go. You need to learn how to be put back in society. I think the reason that safe houses are such a needed place is it gives a girl a changed venue. It's like telling a crackhead don't smoke crack, but they still live in the crack house. And so one of the things, this is just a quote about the safe house, we ended up having to close it in 2007 because of budget cuts. And so just to give you a sense of when we talk about service provision, we are also dealing with the reality of we are in California, we're in a recession. So all of these things that survivors need to survive, we get impacted too when things start to get cut. And so 2007, we closed our safe house because we could no longer fund it. But we then began a Reclaim Your Rights campaign. And so it was in partnership with United Way. You could call 211 and get connected to the SAGE project. It was in multiple languages. We handed out mirrors and chapsticks that also said the same messaging of, has anyone taken your ID, passport, or freedom, working under threat of debt or violence? And it was our Reclaim Your Rights campaign. It was in Thai, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, Tagalog, Russian, Spanish, and English. It also included pole banners throughout the city. Actually, one of the cases that we received was because a survivor saw one of the pole banners and she said, that's me. And so she called us and she was connected to us. But this is some of the imagery and it has the same language. And we really wanted to centralize a number, which now everyone here probably knows about the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, so you know you can call them. But at the time, it wasn't really kicking up in the same way, and so we were trying to figure out locally, how do you know where to call? You just call 211 because they're the one that connects you to every service provider in the Bay. So in 2009, we then received our grants with the Office of Victims of Crimes grant, which we are one of three organizations in the entire country to actually be funded federally to work to provide direct services for survivors, children, domestic minors of human trafficking, sex or labor. And we are also funded in partnership, or the other fund, the recipients of the funds are Safe Horizons in New York and Salvation Army in Chicago. And this really gave us an opportunity to do something very different and unique, which is provide services for domestic minors. But it also meant that we really needed to understand the definitions of human trafficking, which for sex trafficking of minors, as many of you probably already know, you do not need to show force, fraud, or coercion. How many of you have seen the AMP model, the action means process? Oh, wow, maybe I should have done a 101, huh? Well, this is your 101 really quickly. This is how we break down the definition of human trafficking. This is called the AMP model, but ignore the slash. So it looks more like this. And it says sex and labor on the end. So the AMP model, what that means is you need an action, which could be someone recruits, arbors, transports, provides, or obtains a person. And you need a means for through force, fraud, coercion, and so forth for the purpose of their sex or labor. So that's our legal definition. All you need is one across each column. You just need one in each column. So a guerrilla pimp that's a name that we call pimps that literally kidnap minors. They will obtain a girl through force, literally kidnap her, right? Or abduction, we could say abduction. You just need one of them for the purpose of her sex. That's human trafficking. A family member, an aunt, an uncle, they recruit a family member through fraud. They tell you lies. They say, if you come to the United States, you can be a nanny and you can go to school. You can have all this money and help your family if you come to the United States. So through fraud, for the purposes of their labor. So they keep them in domestic servitude. That's human trafficking, just one across. So you don't need to fill the boxes up. You just need to have one item for it to be human trafficking. And so with domestic minors, we do need to show, though, force, fraud, or coercion. So coercion is, if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, I'm going to kill your family, which many of the people that we work with will experience. If you don't do what I tell you, the police are going to come and pick you up and they're going to arrest you. So the opportunity for the SAGE project is that it means that we now provide services for boys and trans people. This is the first of its kind. Oftentimes when we think about human trafficking, we think about women and girls, but we forget about all the other genders and all the other age spectrums in which people are trafficked. We also have been able to complicate what it means to provide services for minors of human trafficking. It doesn't look the same when you're working with internationals versus when you're working with children. And we also then have a new opportunity in which sex trafficking means exchange of anything with value. So I'm going to share this with you because it's actually really important. One of the things that we know about sex trafficking of minors is that you can be a child that is saying to someone, I just need a bed. Can I stay at your place? The second this person says, yeah, you can sleep in this bed. You can stay at my apartment or wherever it is. But all you need to do is sleep with me. That's sex trafficking, because now the thing is value, and that person is their trafficker. So what does service provision look like? We oftentimes think of these steps for serving internationals of human trafficking as very simple. They're trafficked, they're identified, which, as Kate has already shared with us, it's actually very difficult to identify, but we oftentimes assume that's going to happen. They're connected to services, they're stabilized, and they integrate, or they return home. But what we know is that oftentimes they may be trafficked into the United States, identified, but never connected to services. So they never get the support that they need to heal. Or they may be connected to services, but no one ever identifies them to actually give them the kind of services that they need as a trafficking survivor. They may be trafficked into the United States and integrate, so generationally start experiencing trafficking. So what we've seen is, parents are trafficked, they survive it, then their children become survivors of human trafficking because there's a generational connection. But in the worst case scenario, they're trafficked into the United States and we never know what happens to them. With domestic minors of human trafficking, we also hope for the same spectrum of they will eventually thrive on their own. But the reality is that for domestic minors, what we are seeing, and this is just a lesson to share with you, is that they're trafficked into the U.S., then they end up in the criminal justice system because everyone wants to just call them a bad kid. They continue to run away because that's what you do when you're surviving trauma. You go to your instinct. If your instinct is to run because that helped you survive something else, you're going to run. And that's what they do. They AWOL. They may be re-exploited because they become drug dependent, which we don't often see in the youngest cases that we work with, but it sometimes happens. Many times what we see is that the survivors of human trafficking that are minors end up self-soothing with drugs when they're older, so they look a lot like our adult populations of survivors that are in prostitution. And so just as a reminder, the average entry age into prostitution is 13 years old. And then they grow up to be adult surviving. So some quick recommendations to share with you, and just three recommendations as far as if you're going to continue to help us, help the Freedom House, help the SAGE Project, help whoever it is that you're working with locally to do anti-trafficking work. There's three basic recommendations: trauma-informed lens, realistic capacity, and building partnerships. And so what is a trauma-informed lens? The reality is that human trafficking is traumatic. So you are working with someone that has been highly traumatized, has histories of trauma. And so you need to know what that means. And that therapy is not a cross-cultural concept. We struggle to refer clients into mental health services because for them, only crazies go to therapy. Also, the other thing that we know about human trafficking is that human trafficking is a unique trauma, but it does intersect with other forms of violence. It doesn't mean that, you know, if you're a survivor of domestic violence that you will be trafficked, or that if you're a survivor of child abuse that you will be trafficked. But we have seen cases in which survivors have experienced all three: domestic violence, human trafficking, and child abuse. And so we want to be realistic that those are the connections of violence that we see. And that trauma, when we think about substances, oftentimes we think that people just want to do drugs because that's what they want to do. But actually, when you are self-soothing with drugs, it's because you're taking care of something. And so what we recognize at the SAGE Project is that people that are involved with substances is that they're self-soothing from some form of trauma. And so what we call is the substance use will, the trauma and the substance use will. And what we see with our clients especially is you're traumatized, you start using drugs to take care of yourself, then you participate in activities that make you vulnerable to exploitation, and then you're traumatized again, and it happens over and over. So with a realistic capacity, I'm not going to go into this in very much detail. There are many factors that lead someone to being exploited. So being aware of those multiple systems of that create human trafficking, whether it's economic, social, political, environmental. And those same common push-pull factors are the same for minors, whether as they are for internationals, but not the story isn't the same. And so, for example, with the media, you know, for internationals that come to the United States, they may be coming to the United States because they've been told that you can acquire the American dream. For the minors that we work with, they are already here, so they're not going anywhere to acquire an American dream. But what they know is they see in the media is that the video vixen, so that's what sexy is. Or they see things such as pimp culture being normalized. And there are many barriers for survivors of human trafficking, from cultural, isolation, fear, physical, and trauma in general. And so knowing what your capacity is really important. We know that we are trying to support survivors of human trafficking with every single need that they may have, but it's really based on the needs that they need. And so we are working with survivors where they're at. And so what we find is that because housing is so limited, we put in a lot of energy into getting them housing because not everyone wants to go in a shelter, as well as legal services and so forth. And so with partnerships, this is important to know what exists and know what is needed. We are here together at the Freedom Summit. This is what exists. Now we need to figure out what is needed. And so just to give you a sense of how you can stay connected, we do have at our table this sort of cool little thing of how you can get involved. At the top of it is the same need, donate. We all do need money. But if you can't donate, there's many ways you can be involved. You can train others, you can collect resources for victims, you can teach your community, and you can stay connected with SAGE. You can pick up one of these either in the back if we run out. We do have a table in the expo, as well as we have brochures. But if you or someone you know, you can either call the National Human Trafficking Resource Hotline, or you can always call us. We're more than welcome, we're more than open to talking with you if you think you see something happening in your community, because we know that survivors aren't the typical ball and chain story hidden away. They exist in the community. As Nola Brantley was once quoted with Missy, and we do have a board of director here with us from Missy, which is an organization that works with commercially sexually exploited children, said, is that many of the survivors may be going to church. And so I'm just going to stop there and open it up to questions, so then that gives us 30 minutes to talk through about anything that you guys may want to know more about. So there's a mic up here if you want to come up to it to ask questions. And Kate, do you want to come back?
I recently encountered a young woman with a child from Romania outside a Walmart with a sign saying, please, I need help, I need food. And so I went in and bought her food and brought it back to her. I asked her a few questions, but it didn't sound good, and now I really need to know what questions should I have asked her to obtain correct information if she needed more help than what I was just able to give her then.
You know, actually, one of the things I want to commend you on, and I don't want you to beat yourself up on for the kinds of questions that you ask, But actually, the Asian Anti-Trafficking Collaborative has what they, at the first, they were calling the Good Samaritan Initiative. And one of the things that they found is that oftentimes, the reason why we ignore human trafficking survivors is because we ignore them, right? So they're your neighbor that no one notices. But one of the cases that came out of Antioch was from someone just being a friendly person saying hello every single day, mm-hmm. consistently to that person. So when that person was able to leave, the first thing they did was they ran to that person. I think that you're not going to find all of the answers when you first meet someone because they don't know you. And so it's really hard to ask those hard questions. It's not always going to come out. Not all survivors do what, not a very nice way to describe it, but puke information out mm-hmm. in the first encounter. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that I really encourage you to do is all we can do is share with them resources and then hope that they will themselves through their own resiliency, because you know what? One of the most challenging steps is taking that first step, but it needs to happen from them. We can't force it.
So you're saying then, if I had been able to hand her some information with a resource, mm-hmm. that could have then given her a link or a bridge when she was ready to use it, if indeed that was her case. See, I don't mm-hmm. know to this day. Yeah. It only just occurred to me listening to yeah. you now that that could have been her situation. She talked about having a brother that she lived in Los Angeles, but mm-hmm. she was in the North Bay, Santa Rosa, I mean, you know, that was just odd now that I'm putting these pieces together. So I was just wanting to know what kinds of things could I right. initiate conversation to be able to ascertain whether this really is a human trafficking situation or not.
Yeah, and all we can encourage folks to do is the first step is share resources because the survivor really does need to take the step, and they're the ones that are going to decide, does that make sense to me? Because if you're an agency that works with prostitution, as the SAGE Project does, but we also work with human trafficking, people don't know that our survivors, they don't know what that is.
Right.
Giving them recommendations for referrals that you think may locally help them and can connect them. So this partnership regionally is really important because we all need to know what is out there, right? And so I think, Kate, maybe I don't know if you have any other.
Yeah, I just want to add one other thing, too. You know, it's also good, you can also contact an agency in the area to kind of let them know about the situation. They may have other resources or know about the person or may have other ways to reach out to them. Just because sometimes you had an opportunity to talk to that person, but you don't always have an opportunity to talk to that person. It might just be someone you see and notice and you think something is suspicious. And it could actually be dangerous for you or that person if you go in and engage, depending on if their exploiter is nearby or controlling them. So it's also good when you don't have that opportunity to reach out to an agency as well and let them know.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. I was just going to ask about services for young boys. You hear about these homes, and pretty much all the ones I've heard about are for young women. Mm-hmm. And I guess my concern is, what is being done for young boys? And is there anything in process or currently existing to house them?
Yeah, with the SAGE Project, we do work with boys. And so what we can do is we work currently in partnership with Larkin Street Youth Services as well as with CPS to locate housing for them. Not always the best situation because Larkin Street Youth Services is a homeless shelter for youth. And the CPS systems may be the very systems that are exploiting them. And so we know that's still a challenge, but we're working with them in partnership to train them so they can be effective in how they support. We also are in the process to develop a drumming circle for boys. And so that's something that we are doing so that boys can work, you know, they can also have their own circles of healing. So that's something we're doing at the SAGE Project. We do provide comprehensive services, and we have case managers that can work with them specifically to access the other needs that they may have.
I don't think I have anything to add. Basically, the same thing. There isn't enough housing. There's enough options and resources out there for them. And same thing, we've had to work with the other agencies that may not be specialized working with this population, but they might have housing or services specific to boys, and they just kind of had to fit in, which isn't the best option, but that's what exists.
And I guess a follow-up to that is, in foster care or CPS, maybe you don't know this, but are you able to specifically request, if you have specialized training, request victims of human trafficking?
So the thing is it goes back to the identification, though. And so really, it's a matter of training people to really understand what human trafficking is, because the reality is they can then make the referral. So if they are the CPS worker that is working with this child, they're probably the person that knows this child, and they can refer them out. So that's all we can really do. We can't make people refer anything because, again, we're service providers. We don't force people into services. And actually, we really want this to be empowering for them. And so if they're interested in coming in for services, again, like one of the things that we always say is that we are a success because of all the clients that walk through our doors, right? So they make us a success. And so they really need to initiate that stuff, too.
Thanks.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could comment on the process after international victims are found. I know that in some cases they're immediately sent back because they're illegally here, and then they're vulnerable to being sucked into trafficking again. So with the housing and with other resources that you provide, what happens in a case when someone is here illegally because they were forced to come without proper documentation?
Do you want to start?
That's a really good question. Unfortunately, it still happens. People still get deported without being identified. Mm-hmm. That's why the training and outreach and awareness raising is still critical. I mean, that's still happening here. I think one of our challenges, and we get asked this, how do you rescue people? How do you rescue people? We don't rescue people, actually. We're just the home, we're the aftercare. Survivors get referred to us from community-based organizations, Good Samaritans, law enforcement, medical, and et cetera. So they work on investigation and identifying, and we really rely on the first responders and the other agencies to do the identification, which is a challenge. So if there is an identification of an international person as a potential victim of human trafficking, then we're one of the many agencies like SAGE that get referrals for them for services. So when they come to our home, for instance, mm-hmm. They have a place to stay. We don't work with the law enforcement or the legal aspects. We refer that out to a number of the other agencies in the area, and you'll probably hear them around today. There's a few, APLO, Catholic Charities, a number of different agencies that work in this sector. And they work with the law enforcement to do the steps so mm-hmm. that people can stay here during the process of the investigation to determine their status and to determine what the next steps are. So we're just kind of a holding place in right. the other care.
I think it really depends how we get referred the case. And so a slide I didn't really go into detail because I was like, oh my God, I'm hogging all the time, so I better run right through. But one of the things that we do is we get referrals to crisis line, education. So we've been referred cases through teachers themselves, medical system, so SF General Hospital to clinics, the task force. So there's a North Bay task force, there's a South Bay task force, and then there's the East Bay task force, as well as family members, Good Samaritans, people self-referring themselves because they read about human trafficking and they say that looks like me. As well as the bigger numbers they'll really come from, and you can't really see it, is they come from illegal firms as well as governmental agencies. So such as an example is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Mexican Consulate is another one that we get many of our referrals from. But the number one referral is other service providers, so other community-based organizations such as Freedom House, because we're the ones that people are going to probably call first. And so then we work together. So what happens to the survivor when we get that call? It really depends on how they came in. Okay. If they come in through law enforcement, our goal is to really provide them with the services that they need. If we're the first responders and it doesn't come in from law enforcement, then our job then is really to figure out what can we do for them legally, because we don't want them to be deported. Mm-hmm. And so we get them an immigration lawyer. We get them represented right away. And then the next step is then they do the interviews with law enforcement and so forth. The worst case scenario, and we've had these cases as well, they're already in jail. They're already in deportation proceedings. And in those cases, all we can really do is get them other lawyers, a deportation lawyer such as the Asian Law Caucus or APLO, to really work with their immigration needs. And so again, it depends on what the case looks like. That's what makes this work so hard and so challenging. And that's why we're really here saying, this is great that we're all here together, because we need more support. Because the challenge is that there takes so much work. Each case is case specific. There is no one case profile. They don't look like those simple steps. And so we really work with them where we're getting them. In other cases that we've received, they've been trafficked 10 years ago, right? So they were trafficked, and there's a 10-year statute of limitations on human trafficking. And so if you are trafficked 11 years ago, 12 years ago, you have no legal remedies. Another crime needs to happen to you for you to get another sort of legal support. And so we really do our best to work with the case. But yeah, we do have those worst case scenarios too.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hello. So I don't know if you guys can speak much to this, but I'm wondering about prosecutions, especially when you're working with the minor children. Do you guys see a lot of prosecutions with the traffickers, or are victims encouraged to pursue, like filing lawsuits against them or anything like that?
Sage has worked on prosecution cases. The ones that we've seen more successfully in San Francisco are international. It's really dependent on the DA and SFPD, because we're not law enforcement. So they're the ones that need to investigate. Law enforcement investigates, then they propose it, whether it's to your local DA or to your US attorney, the case. So in San Francisco, we haven't seen a lot, but Alameda's been really successful at prosecuting with other types of crimes. Many times victims do need to speak up, especially if they're domestic cases, and that's a challenge, because oftentimes what we're working with is, you don't want to be visible, you don't want to see your perpetrator again. Getting a restraining order in itself is hard, because if you want to get a restraining order, guess who you're going to see on that table next to you? You're going to see your perpetrator. And so even with those basic steps, many survivors have a hard time taking those steps because they don't want to see their abuser. And so it is hard just even getting those needs, but we encourage them to do what is best for them. Yeah. And so whatever it is that they need, because again, we are not law enforcement. Law enforcement has other things and other agendas, and they may need them, but for us, we just want to support them and where they need to go.
You know, there's a lot of legal issues. You know, there's the criminal, what you're referring to, the prosecutions. They also potentially have civil cases as well, and then their immigration. I mean, for international immigration in the U.S., not so much. But so it's really difficult pursuing any one of those things. Mm-hmm. And what we've been asked sometimes is, can I get a visa where I don't have to go and prosecute? Because the T visa, you know, a lot of these visas that are available for victims, they have very steep requirements to meet so that you are eligible. One of the four main elements is that you participate, you respond to any reasonable requests by prosecution. That's really, really scary. I mean, to go up against your exploiter and trafficker to confront them so that you can stay here, that's really scary. So we even get asked, do I have to do that? Is there any other visa that I could qualify for where I don't have to see that person or press charges, I'm afraid? And the other interesting thing is that for us, especially, you know, for US citizens, there may not be a benefit for pressing charges. It's really scary, again, to go up against your trafficker. You may not be ready for it. It could be a family member even. Mm-hmm. There's just so many reasons you don't want to do it. So we don't limit who can stay at the house based on that. So if it, you know, if this person, you know, they're here, they're U.S. citizen, whatnot, and they don't want to press charges, we still will consider them a victim of human trafficking as long as they meet those elements. We don't require proof from the law enforcement, yes, I'm a victim of trafficking.
Right, but just to add for international survivors, again, just to remind folks, is that they do need to at least interview with law enforcement. They need to cooperate. And so if they're at least interviewing with them, that's their cooperation. And so we usually hope, and the client usually hopes, that their case doesn't have to go criminal, because then they don't have to worry about those things if they don't want it to. And many of the cases don't go criminal. There's a very, what was the number that you gave? I don't remember. There was a number you threw out there of how many convictions?
114 charges, I think.
Yeah, it's very little.
43 convictions.
Yeah. Yes, it's very little. And so the reality of it going criminal, it really is dependent on our U.S. attorney and the DA.
I have one more question. this is for Sage. So when you're trying to refer victims for housing or anything like that, do you have any federal grants that help you subsidize their rent or deposits?
Depends on the population. So for domestic minors, yes, because we're funded with Office of Victims of Crime, so we do have particular funds set aside for them. Mm-hmm. For internationals, we only have it up for a 3-month, depending on it's, again, the politics, because there's other federally funded agencies, so then we have to work with that. So yes and no, depending on where they're at.
Okay.
So we don't have unlimited funds. We actually don't have enough funds oftentimes to even have them get their basic needs met, which is such as buy a bus pass, pay for your phone, to talk to your family. Food, you know, food stamps, many of them are on food stamps, they're getting the regular benefits met, but just to feel like a normal person, it's oftentimes the first year is the most challenging point, because oftentimes they don't have authorizations to work, so if they work, they're going to work under the table, and that means that they're working, they're vulnerable to being re-exploited. But for housing, yes and no, depending on the population. If you're interested in talking more, you should connect with us because we're more than happy to strategize with you on how we can work in partnership.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
This is kind of specific to Sage. You had mentioned that counseling isn't culturally like acceptable to all different areas, but with minors, I think we talked about in the main group, it's still that psychological hold and that fear that they have. So how do you guys address that or work with that?
So our life skills program is the workings of that. And it's called life skills, but it's not the kind of life skills that you typically think of, which is like college access, those kinds of things. It's the life skills of things such as having conversations with them about gangs, having conversations with them about pimp control, having conversations with them about domestic violence, with peers talking with them about it, and them talking with each other. And so it really starts with the peer model for us in that way, because one of the things is that it's really different for someone to say, that sounds really bad, like you should not do that, versus someone that says, I know what you're going through because I've been there, and I know it's really hard. And so it's a really different sort of feel and a sort of connection. And so the peer model becomes really useful. We then have to sometimes be harm reduction, though, because sometimes the survivors, for whatever reason, especially with the adult populations, continue to stay in exploitive situations, stay in abusive relationships. And so we support them and know that it's like domestic violence. It may take them 7 tries to leave. And so we support them so that they're constantly reminded that we're there with them, for them, no matter what, and that we hope that they'll make the healthiest decisions for themselves. But yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge when you have psychological, especially with children, because these are kids, right? Their whole identity is being formed by their trauma. They're growing up traumatized and they're normalizing it. And so that's why for us, it's a challenge, and we're glad that we are able to do the work, but we know there's so much more work that needs to be done because we're just one small agency.
I know you spoke a little bit about group counseling, so I was curious about the different types of therapies or like schools of thought, like if some were a little more effective, like I don't know about the different types of psychotherapies and and stuff, so.
We have a lot of programs.
Yeah, we do. Actually, so the SAGE project, we believe that trauma happens in the body. So where the healing starts happens in the body. So we are very informed by somatic therapy as well as EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. So our clinician is an EMDR specialist. That's what she does. And we believe in that because we've seen it work. It helps you to be in the present if you're able to be in your body. Otherwise, you can talk as much as you want. Sometimes the conversations are not enough because if you're sitting in a room and you smell something and you're suddenly back 10 years ago in your trauma, talking through it isn't always going to help you. And so you need to be aware of what's going on with your body and then figure out, how do I change it? How do I change what's going on? So then that way, the next time it happens, it doesn't happen again, and I just run out of the room. And so it's a challenge, but we've seen it be effective, primarily with the adults, though. The youth that we work with are not interested in mental health services in the same way. They love talking, and it works for them. But that's something that we're trying to figure out as a next step, is how can we introduce somatic therapy with them or body therapy, and so we'll see.
One more question. Is there a model in place of like most effective therapy that is used internationally? Like, is there some kind of comprehensive program exactly?
You may want to, for myself, I can't say I personally, I'm not a mental health clinician, so I'm just going to be really, I'm not the police, I already said that. I'm also not a lawyer, Kate is, but I'm also not a mental health clinician. And so, I only know what I know of, and so Rachel Irwin is our clinician. She's our clinical director, and she is here. So if you want, we can give you her contact information, and you can always contact her directly.
Thank you.
Because she's done work internationally.
It's also an interesting question, because as you raised, Annie, you said that, you know, in some different cultures, they have different perspectives of mental health. So it's almost difficult to have probably a universal system.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I also am not a mental health expert. I really don't know anything about mm-hmm. what would be best. But we're also just looking at other types of supportive models, you know, not in strict therapy. If mm-hmm. people can even just come together and do simple art together and, you know, really just some basic things and companionship. I know we're also looking at a peer-led support group as well, just where people can, you know, get together and share, and, you know, a person who knows how to lead the peer groups can do that as well.
I completely forgot, which is my bad, or whatever, is acupuncture. We have found that being really effective with all of our clients. We provide acupuncture for all of our clients as well as for us. We get it if we need it, which we do. And so acupuncture has been really effective because you don't have to talk. It's like art therapy. It's not a mode that in which you need to have the language access or have the language competency, because sometimes talking through stuff, people have other things, other insecurities come up. Nonverbal forms of therapy have been really effective.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi. So when providing services to these survivors, how do you kind of equip them for the aftercare? And I think this is more, you know, pertinent maybe to like a shelter like the Freedom House. How do you kind of foster that self-sufficiency after they exit services?
That's an excellent question, actually. And I can't say that, oh, here's our success story, because we've only been for 6 months. I don't have those. But the plan is, and I think, you know, all the considerations we've taken, there's other transitional homes, not necessarily for trafficking victims, mm-hmm. but other types of transitional homes that we've really looked to for models. And it's tough. I mean, it's really tough. And with this population specifically, it may take a really, really, really long time just to get their basic needs met, to get signed up for all the services, to get their visa or work authorization or whatever, and to deal with the trauma that is just an ongoing challenge for a long, long time. So we understand that it's going to take a lot of time for people. Our founder, executive director, actually said if there's individuals that need to stay a little bit longer than 18 months, we need to do that. But the goal is to provide the basic skills and services that they need to be able to go into independence and then work with them through that process. And I mean, basically, that could look like any number of things. Everyone is so completely different. Every case, as Annie said, is so unique. So it really means having an individual care plan that says, okay, where are you now? Where do you need to be in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months to kind of, you know, make sure that you are at a point where you can leave? And then what do we do to help foster you to get there? You know, is it looking at other affordable housing options? Because it's really expensive, if anyone hasn't noticed, to live in this area. Mm-hmm. I'm not from here, I'm from the Midwest, so I find it pretty shocking. So this is, it's really difficult actually to find affordable housing even afterwards. So we'll have to work with other programs that provide affordable housing. I mean, some people develop communities, they might find roommates, different things like that. But then they might need continual connection and other support as they're going out. I mean, that experience doesn't leave you, even though you become more and more self-sufficient, independent, ready to leave. You still need other services.
Yeah, for us, we're actually, one of the things that Sage is excellent at, there's two things. We're good with working with clients that are in crisis. We're good with working with clients, stabilizing them. But thriving, we really want them to move beyond Sage. So when they thrive, we want them to no longer need us. Because they're going to thrive by working, by being in school. And so our goal is to really get them to that place where they can do it independently and not be in the space in which they're constantly with other people that have histories of trauma. So that's been our model. And I think that one of the things is that we've seen clients that have gotten there that are now independently trying to start their own businesses. That's a, you know, a case, you know, that is a success. They also may be in school. We have survivor staff. So these are people that have been through programs that now have MSWs. And so those are things that we've seen be a success. But part of us, the model of what helps someone get there is that they do need to independently take those steps alone. And so we don't handhold with them for their entire life, because if we had to do that, then we wouldn't be successful.
Right. I guess I'm thinking of the of the profile of like a specific client where mm-hmm. I imagine they would be disempowered. So then mm-hmm. Without any resources, so then do you just, at the Freedom House, do you just refer out to another transitional housing agency or?
I'm sorry, you said if people are disempowered and?
Without any resources, like coming into your home or the house as a, you know, and they don't have a place to stay or any kind of resources to go into society, do they just get referred out to like another transitional housing place or?
So we're up to 18 months, which is a pretty okay. fair length of time. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's, you know, expected that they get connected to the services that they need to be able to kind of financially support themselves.
Okay.
They may not, and you're going to, most people, I mean, there's a lot of transitional programs that really work with people to find additional affordable housing afterwards because it is pretty expensive. But
one thing Sage used to have that we don't have because of shrinking capacity is that we used to have a tutor program, and that was for our alumni and our, I guess, more senior clients that were pretty much out the door. And so if you're interested or know someone that can help us reinvigorate that, we do have a model for it, and we do have people that are ready to be tutored, including you know, many people that want to be tutored. And so that was something we did try in-house because we found that many of the survivors wanted to only come in to Sage for services. They were terrified of going somewhere else because trying something new had traumatized them before. And so I think that that's something we try to work with them in taking those steps, hand-holding, going with them to new meetings, referring them out, but it's a challenge.
Okay, thank you.
Just wanted to ask really quickly about your John School and what you see happening. Do you see that those perpetrators are actually healed, or where do they go after John School?
Yeah, where do they go after John School? I don't know if they're the ones that need that kind of healing in the same way, but we do see change. That's something I've been a witness to. You have these guys that come in there, they've been arrested by the police, and they're like, I don't know why I'm here. I didn't do anything wrong. Like it's all her. It's her fault. And so what we would, what I would see is that in the beginning they're resistant, but by the end of the day they want to know, how can we help Sage? And that's really fascinating because you've gone from being a perpetrator that was arrested to someone that is like, oh my God, this prostitution does this to people. And so it's been really amazing. And one of the reasons why it's really effective is because survivors come and speak to them. And they tell them what happens to them because they have these notions that these girls just want to do it. And they're like, well, it's their choice. But it's really hard when you start to hear someone telling their story and they're like, you know, I had a child to feed, I was homeless, I was drug dependent, I was this, this, and this, and that's why I was in it. And now I'm here, but that's where I was, and that's what it was like for me. And it's really intense, but it's really, I think, important. It's empowering for the survivor as well as for them. And so I think that, you know, we do see that kind of change. They're diverse, though, just so you know, to paint a picture of who these guys are. They're all races, they're all classes, they're, you know, well, they're primarily men, and, you know, there may be a few women that do participate. We know it happens in other countries and it happens here, but they're not being arrested, so that's what it is. And they may be all genders, but right now we only know they're all races and all classes, and so I don't want to stereotype, this is type A, John. We don't see that. Well, I see everyone else looks a little bit shy to head to the mic. We have about 4 minutes before we wrap up. If there's any other questions, you can also shout from your seat. Oh, do you? Yeah.
I just have a quick question. You're from San Mateo County, is that?
We're in San Mateo County.
And you're in San Francisco, and I live in the East Bay. So when you talk about local services, is there anything in the East Bay that's similar, mm-hmm. for example, that...
Well, we don't have jurisdiction like that. So we will go for our programs, depending on the case that we're looking at, we may be able to go to you. So we have cases that are in Marin, that are in Solano counties, that are in San Mateo counties, as well as in the East Bay. So we work wherever we are. So what I encourage you to do is if you see something and you want to connect someone to us, call us, because if we are not the best person for them, we have the partnerships and we will refer them out.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. it's still active. I think we may need to retrain them again, but it's still a number that you can call for service provision wherever you are. United Way has been doing trainings. Other states have been picking it up as their initiative as well. But you can also call the National Human Trafficking Hotline, because they also can connect you to any local direct service provider, advocacy group, and so forth. Yeah, everyone that we've worked with is referred to us through law enforcement, medical, community-based organizations like SAGE, other ones. We have just direct referrals. I mean, we just have referrals. I think it's ours is interesting. We have self-referrals because we have peers that know of someone else. And so then that's why when you are someone that's surviving and then you know that your friend's surviving the same way, that's been really interesting. We've seen it a lot with our adult population. It's been picking up with our minors. They're in juvenile justice center. They all know about us, and then they all start coming into our groups. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you.